I am your host, Mark McBride-Wright, founder and managing director of Equal Engineers, and I believe that every engineer has a story to tell. The Equal Engineers podcast uncovers the diversity story behind leading engineers and those working with the profession championing change. Hear from leaders, academics, entrepreneurs, and agents of change, truly transforming the understanding of who engineers are and what engineers do. Don Bonfield is a Royal Society Entrepreneur in Residence at King's College London and Royal Academy of Engineering Visiting Professor of Inclusive Engineering at Aston University. She is founder and director of Towards Vision, a company which works towards a vision of diversity and inclusion in engineering, and founder of the Magnificent Women Social Enterprise, which celebrates the diversity and history of women in engineering and uses their inspiring heritage to encourage the next generation of engineers. Dawn is past president and former chief executive of the Women's Engineering Society. By background, Dawn is a materials engineer and spent many years working in the aerospace industry on composite materials. She is the UK representative on the World Federation of Engineering Organisations and deputy chair of the Women in Engineering Committee, focusing on the application of engineering and technology to address the Sustainable Development Goals, with a particular emphasis on addressing the disadvantages faced by women. She has also recently been a member of the Engineering Design T-Level panel. Dawn, how are you?
Hello, Mark. I'm very well, thank you. Thank you for asking me to join you.
It's an absolute pleasure. It's an absolute pleasure. So, as you know, I've wanted to start these podcasts to really capture the stories of people who are front face of making change in our sector. And you've been a huge inspiration for me ever since we met, about 5 or 6 years ago, when I was thinking about going freelance and becoming making that transition from being an engineer in industry. And I remember hearing you talk at Women Engineering Society event at the Institution of Engineering and Technology. I think it was back in 2013 or 2014, when it was still National Women Engineering Day and hadn't yet quite moved to International Women in Engineering Day. And it was from that event that I just thought, this is exactly the sort of cause that I want to be helping. And so with our podcasts, we like to hear split into two halves, where we hear a bit about the person, we go back, we find out about the history, how you got to where you're at, what you're doing now, and then a bit of time hearing about the work that you're doing now, and you know, some of the key things that you see coming up for the profession. So if we start at the beginning, then let's go back. where did you grow up? What was the young Dawn like?
Gosh, it's a long time ago. I grew up in Lancashire. I was born in Lancashire. And I grew up partly in Lancashire, and then we moved around as a family because my dad was an engineer for Pilkington's, the glass company. Yeah. And so we moved with his job. So first of all, he worked in Latham and St Helens, and then we moved to North Wales where he worked in St Asaph. We lived in Prestatyn. And then after that, we moved down to South Wales where he worked in Cwmbran, and we lived in Abergavenny. So I've grown up in those three different places and moved around schools quite a number of times, I guess. You were asking me, what was the young Dawn like?
Yes, I was. So what was the young Dawn like?
Liking work. I liked sport, which was good, you know, something to have that was different and allowed me to make friends, I guess. But yeah, definitely I remember being shy at school and quite introverted, I guess.
And school can be a difficult place, I guess, especially when you're moving around from place to place. Mm-hmm. And did you ever feel like did you know that a move was on the horizon and so you never quite fitted
No.
in, always sort of transient?
I don't think I ever knew that a move was on the horizon, but I just know that I don't know why, really. I think I was just basically shy and basically studious. And so, liked studying, liked school, whereas other people possibly didn't like school as much as I did. And I think, you know, in today we talk about finding your tribe. Mm-hmm. And I think I found my tribe when I was in the sixth form, and I came out of my O levels at the time, and then moved into a sixth form where I was with every day the people that I, you know, related to, I guess. Okay. So I think that's where I came out of myself a bit more and found my friendship groups.
So if we go back to that time, how would you describe those days? And was that then the start of your journey into engineering?
Oh, I'm sure it was. Yes, I did. In my sixth form, I did. I remember when we moved down from Prestatyn to Abergavenny, I started off in the lowest of the O-level groups. They hadn't put me in the top streams because the schools were streamed. It was a massive comprehensive school in Abergavenny. And I just remember being lost in these kind of lower set O-level groups, and then moving up to the top sets and doing well in my O-levels. But then when I came into the sixth form, I was in a double maths group. So we did maths A-level after the first year, and then we did another two maths A-levels in the second, and physics and chemistry and general studies, because they're very keen on that in Wales. But I was in a group of six people in my double maths set.
Wow.
So I spent a lot of time with that small group, and we had really, really good careers advice, I think, from the teachers. And we all applied to Oxbridge, so we got a lot of help with that. I didn't go to Oxbridge, I went to Bath University. But it was really, I didn't really have any of the barriers that I see very often in young girls that don't have either that science capital or that engineering capital at home, or they don't have those supportive school structures that help them into a career in science or engineering. And I did science, actually, so I did material science. I had quite an easy pathway into that career, I guess.
And Bath is a beautiful city to study in. So how can you take us back to some of your days there and what it was like being a female student on the material science degree program?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I have great memories of my degree. We were on a course of 16 students. There are only 16 of us. I think there were 11 lecturers. I still keep in touch with the lecturers even now, which I think probably doesn't happen these days when you have such big classes. But yeah, we had a really, really nice, friendly material science department. And I'd gone there, actually. One of the reasons I'd gone to Bath was because I'd done three of those work, those summer schools where you can go to different universities and try out different courses.
Oh, yeah.
So I'd done that in three different places and decided that material science was the thing that I liked. So, yeah, I had a great time there. You know, we knew students on the other years either side of us as well. And that's where I met my husband, who was older than me and a material scientist as well, a couple of years older.
I love
it. Yeah, it was a great, great family feeling at Bath University. And it's a very small campus as well. Well, now it's not. It's quite a big campus now. But at that time, it was quite a small campus. And great, great place to be. Great memories.
And you mentioned summer schools and trying out different courses.
Mm-hmm.
I remember doing a Head Start engineering course. You're taking me back here. I just got a flashback memory. When I was I went to Bradford and did like a 4-day residential. And I think that was a turning point for me that inspired me to understand that of what my interest in chemistry and maths and physics, where it could take me. And then the specific subtypes of engineering available. Do you think, do those events still happen now? Do those summer schools still happen?
Nowhere near as much as I think they should do. I did, when I was at Wes, I did try to compile them every year and send them out to schools. So a list, that there was at one time a directory of them.
Yes,
but that didn't start, obviously didn't get funding any longer. I tried to do that for a while. And I, oh, do you know what? I'd really like to still do that and still know, because I do still careers fairs and going up into schools. And I'd love to be able to say some of those girls, you know, it's really, really worth your while doing this, because you'll figure out what you like and almost as important what you don't like.
Yes.
And then that will really help you then differentiate in terms of engineering what the different disciplines are and what the sectors are that you can go into, because, you know, it's such a complex profession.
Yes,
in terms of qualifications, that I think if you don't have that capital, it's very difficult to get over that barrier and see where you can imagine yourself in the future.
Especially when you've got influencers also influencing your process of thoughts, how you're processing your thoughts. So, and people that you look up to, like careers advisors or your parents, guardians, your teachers, to be able to make independent decisions must be quite overwhelming, I guess, especially with how complicated the pathway routes are. It's going to get even more complicated now with apprenticeships and T-levels.
Yes.
And, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. And it just gives you that headspace, I think, and that time to work things through and to talk to people that aren't your parents, you know, or your school teacher, who, like it or not, they probably have stereotypes of who should and shouldn't go into an engineering career. Whereas when you are on those courses, you see those people that have made that choice, and all of a sudden it becomes a reality.
No, absolutely. So what have been some of the key experiences then that have shaped who you are?
I think, you know, that experience has definitely shaped the career I went into. Without that, I don't know whether I would have. I'm sure I would have gone into some kind of science career or engineering one way or another. I think one of the kind of real pivots in my career was not being able to get back into engineering after I had my children. And I think that really forced my career to take on a very different turn. And I remember when I had my third child and I tried to go back into engineering and work flexibly, it was such a negative experience at that time. And yeah, I had, I still think of it now. I still dream of that now. I had, it was really disturbing time. I'd had a really good career until then. I'd had good career prospects and, you know, always done well. And then when I went back part-time, I was just put into a backwater and a real non-project. And I kept having dreams that I was found out hiding in the lab, not doing any work, because I just felt like I wasn't contributing anything properly that I was going to get found out for being paid and actually not doing anything. And it was a horribly disturbing time. And I left that job and then actually didn't think that I would ever probably go back into engineering, and almost gave up my chartership at that point. And, you know, it just seemed as if I was paying my chartership for something that I was never going to use again. Luckily, I didn't do that. And my dad, I think, persuaded me not to and paid for it. And I took quite a long time out of engineering and then until I came back in afterwards. But, you know, I took quite a lot. And we were speaking earlier, Mark, about finding something that is really relevant and authentic to you. And I feel like one of the things that I think we don't talk about enough are the skills that women in particular gain during that period of their career break or their maternity break. Because when you do come back into a career after having a break, you have so many really, really valuable skills that you didn't have before. And I think as businesses, we haven't really cottoned on to that fact that we can utilize those people on their career breaks much, much more than we do, because effectively they are amazing ambassadors for the company and for the sector. Because they're the stepping stones to the communities that we're desperately trying to reach. You know, they are the ones at the school gate and you know, with friends and friends' children that can be influenced. And so keeping those women in particular who are on that period, or men if they're on career paternity breaks as well, keeping them involved with the business and the training. And then when they're ready to come back in, really making the most of those additional skills that they've gained, I think is something that we don't make the most of, really. So, no,
absolutely. No, I agree with that 100%. Do you think there's more being done now to help returners come back to engineering?
I think there is more generally. I mean, we went through a phase, I think, when it was quite new, a new concept that returnships were kind of quite a new thing that companies did do, you know, a bit of work on trying to get more people in. And I think some of those have continued. In general, possibly there aren't enough of those. And I think we haven't worked hard enough to retain the skills that we have, you know, spent a lot of money on in the engineering sector. And I think, you know, it's for me, really, it's part of the bigger problem that we have around retention. Maybe we'll come on to that a bit later on. But yeah.
So you were a huge source of inspiration for me when I met you, when you were president at the Women's Engineering Society. And it was that panel discussion you were chairing at the IET for National Women in Engineering Day, talking about allyship and, you know, what progress had happened to date at that point on gender equality. How do you feel things are going for gender equality in engineering now? Are we making progress?
I think we are making progress. I have a positive feeling about where we're at and where we're going to. Not necessarily because we've got a lot of progress to show or evidence of where we've made substantial gains, but really I think because the culture has changed.
Okay.
And noticeably. And I think the culture in the UK and in the world, you know, in general, has changed around inequality, and we're much more likely to see inequalities when they occur these days.
Okay.
And we've had really significant, you know, campaigns and movements that have, like Me Too campaign, that have really focused attention on that and given more people the voice to speak up. So I think for me, I think that's where the biggest changes come. And I know that we are getting, in terms of statistics, we are getting more women taking engineering degree courses, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at the overall percentage of women who take any qualification, though, the proportion who take engineering has actually dropped.
Right.
So when you look at it in those terms, then that's a negative. But nevertheless, we are getting more people taking engineering. Okay. And the people that are, you know, in engineering now are much more likely and much more aware of the fact that they need to be ambassadors, and they need to use their voice and their platform and do more to persuade others. And they do. They are definitely doing that. And I feel in some ways that with engineering itself is changing to something that is more owned by more people. And I think in some ways I feel like engineering used to be owned by one group of people. And now we are taking that ownership back. And in doing so, we're changing what engineering looks like. And so we are slightly tipping the balance of who has that control and that power. And I think, you know, women in engineering and any of the minoritized groups in engineering are much more vocal than, you know, your mainstream engineers, because they actually don't need to be vocal about engineering very much. So I think because of that, we are focusing more attention on what it looks like to be maybe different, you know, what is non-traditional in engineering. And that is slightly shifting the picture of what engineering is. So I am seeing change. One of the things that we are seeing more people coming through taking engineering, you know, albeit possibly not a massive shift in percentages of the population that take engineering. One of the things we need to work on, though, is this problem of retention. And, you know, that's something that has been a red flag for a while that we have studiously ignored. And I think we can't continue to ignore the gaping kind of gaps, if you like, in numbers that stay in our industries. So let me just tell you what that number is. It's something like 79% of women of qualified, professionally registered women in engineering leave the profession under the age of 54. So we only have 6% of professionally registered engineers as women anyway. And 79% of those leave under the age of 54. And they stay in engineering. Half of them leave within 10 years, I think it is. There's a new Atkins report that's come out.
Oh, I need to look at that
subject as well. So, yeah, I think we can do more, and we know what we can be doing. So we just need to take that action, I think.
And what do you think are some of the the issues later on in life that are maybe driving that reduction in people being professionally qualified? I've seen a focus happen more recently on the menopause, for example, and trying to remove the taboo of talking around that in the workplace. These women that have been in that age category that have been at the front of the movement for gender equality change, they then get to this stage in the career and then, oh, here comes the menopause and all the challenges that brings. And then it's yet another thing that they need to unpack and educate their male peers on. And do you think, has that played a part in 79% of people leaving by the age of 54?
Do you know what? That's funny you should mention that, because I've just spoken about this at an event, actually, and I read the Atkins report quite thoroughly, and as far as I remember, I couldn't see any mention of menopause. And, you know, there's mention of all sorts of other reasons why women leave the profession, you know, like stereotyping, lack of role models, lack of support groups, lack of networks, harassment in the workplace, you know, poor culture. Menopause has not come up as a reason. Really? But I shouldn't say that without control effing the report and putting menopause in and seeing if menopause comes up, but I would imagine that is a reason why people leave the profession and leave any profession. You know, and engineering is no different to others, possibly in that respect.
There's been some really good there's a group in Aberdeen called the Axis Network, and it's the gender equality network spinning out of the oil and gas network of organizations, net zero organizations, as they're calling themselves now. And they recently did a webinar on menopause in the workplace. And it's almost like this, I've seen it now crop up in a few different places as a spotlight. So there's obviously some movement now happening for the positive, absolutely, in providing that focus in that
area. I think so too. I think it's because, you know, the women are reaching, the women who are likely to be talking about this are reaching now the age where it's happening to them. Mm-hmm. So whereas, you know, obviously it's happened to everybody in the past, but I think it's the women that it's happened to in the past have not maybe felt so comfortable at speaking out about things that are happening. Yeah. And I think that's why you're hearing more about it now. Okay. It's obviously not a new thing, is it? It's just that
biology hasn't changed. As part of your 2018, so 2018 was the year of engineering. And you did a roadshow called Meet the Parents. What gave you the idea for this, and how did it go?
Oh, yeah. So the year of engineering, I talk a lot and I kind of moan a lot about the fact that we don't have a great careers service in engineering. And what I would really like to see is some one-stop shop careers portal, if you like, because we do loads of inspiration for young people. But when it comes to the actual time that they come to choose their next steps, we don't have something that can really help them that is focused on engineering. So you can't, for example, if you're a parent that doesn't really have any science or engineering capital, who you know has a daughter who would probably make a good engineer because you've seen them grow up all their life and you know that they're possibly that way inclined, you can't just pick up the phone to someone and say, you know, this is what, where we're at, how do we know what type of engineering to take, how do we know what A levels we need, you know, tell me all about it. And I think that's such a vacuum in our industry that spends so much time and effort on the inspiration. And so many companies do great outreach activities and inspire people to think that this is a great career for them. That I think, you know, and the model that's really good is the NHS careers. I think they bring all of their careers in the NHS into one place. So if you're interested in any of those, you can phone NHS careers and they will give you all the information you need.
Wow.
So I think we need this in engineering. So rather than me just say this all the time, I thought, okay, this is, you know, I need to put my money where my mouth is and do something about it myself.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I decided that the year of engineering was the time to go out on the road and try and do something that helped those parents really that didn't have the science and the engineering background. So I did, I think, 14 different shows. Wow. And I did shows that were not science and engineering. Well, some of them were actually. So I went to REAT, which is, you know, the International Aircraft Tattoo, which is like my favorite place to go in the world. So I did a few of those, but I also did a lots of like the Bath and West show and the Hay Festival and the Abergavenny Food Fair and all of these places where you just get parents and families just talk to them then and said, you know, did you know it's the year of engineering? And this is a whole load of resources that you can pick up and find out more about careers in engineering that wasn't, you know, directed to one of our disciplines in engineering that tried to, you know, not say, oh, well, of course, we, you know, we're civil engineers and that's the best place to be. And this is what you need to know to be a civil engineer. Because you do get those at careers fair. People come from their own discipline.
But
nobody is there representing the sector as a whole. So that's what I tried to do. And I learned so much from the parents who, and I learned what it was that they were struggling with and from the students. And I have, you know, I had a whole room full of resources that I'd gathered from all over the place. And in fact, I got them out again last week because I went to Alton School to do a careers fair there. So I delved in the shed where they've moved to the shed now. So got them all out again and
I saw the pictures of all the resources. I recognized some of them from our careers fairs, and you know, I've had them stored under my bed, and I now pay for a unit to have them because my husband was just like, Mark, these need to not be in my vision. I know they're important, but you know, we need to store them somewhere.
Yeah, but it reminded me last week of how valuable doing that was, and I'd been to the University of the West of England the week before UWE, who had opened their new engineering building, which is a whole nother story. And it's a fantastic building, which is aimed just at getting more diversity and especially people with autism and neurodiversity. And they'd given me a set of engineering curiosity cards, which are like these top trump cards. And each one of them has a different engineering career on. And honestly, I could not get them out of the hands of the people that were passing the stall. You know, girls in particular and their parents, their mums actually, were saying, oh, look at this one. Look, this is a good one. Oh, I didn't know this was a STEM career. And in the end, I had one packet and I just said to this girl at the very end, you have to just take them with you because, you know, you obviously need them more than I do. So she took them with me. So I don't have them anymore. So I need to get more.
Oh, we'll need to get some printed. Yeah. Definitely.
Really, really valuable. And I think, you know, I could almost see myself just doing that, just offering a service and saying, this is an engineering careers service and going around. Yeah.
I think a key point really is that we need to triangulate all of this work. You know, you work across, so you've got such a unique perspective working across so many cross sections of the sector with different organizations, that really anyone listening to this that could help leverage the work you're doing, the work that we've been doing with schools and employers, and really to try and focus sourcing some funding or some investment to crystallize these ideas. We've already in this short call covered on the need for the summer schools that used to run to help bolster the science capital, because both of us were influenced by them to become the engineers that we are now.
That's right.
And then, you know, a centralized place to bring together all these resources digitally so that they don't have to be in our respective hard copy and rely on our discretionary effort going around to distribute.
That's right.
Them. And then also this career service portal that is a unified point of reference, because I totally take your point. There are so many inspiration outreach sessions, but okay, you spark up that interest. What's the next thing?
What's the next step?
Right. Where do they get directed to? Where you and we should know. We should be able to say, right, go on this place, and this is where you'll find all the information that you need to know around.
That's right.
Different types of engineering, and then where that'll lead you. There's no connected pathway.
No, that's right. You know, and I think there are so many really good resources out there. But when any one organisation sets something up, they're not really there to signpost the other resources. So something that is able to signpost as well to those other organisations without it detracting from, you know, what they're doing themselves, I think, or even just signposting. I know we actually get lots of people who move out of engineering to do this type of thing. So, you know, we've got STEMazing. That's a great startup that's really, really good at inspiring young girls into STEM and engineering. And we've got lots of examples of those. And I think some of our best engineers move out of engineering to do that type of thing as well. So
it's actually a need. It's a need, but it's actually a concern for me, if I'm being honest. I see a lot of these people who want to now run a portfolio career, so they step out of their professional engineering place and start setting something up that is almost a cookie cutter of some of these things. And so there's a real fragmentation in the number of inclusion specialists, for example, that will center on their experience, that are then now offering advisory services to engineering organizations. So if you are an engineering organization who wants to do some work in this space, the fragmentation of service providers is a potential risk that it's going to do more damage than good, because it's too dispersed. It's not coordinated. It's not all working to the one common guiding North Star, you know. It's simply an observation that I've had recently.
No, I think you're right.
And you know, I've been in the game in this now for at least 5 years with Equal Engineers, and so we've made some progress. We've built inroads to employers with institutions. We've built a brand here around this where some of this could live. So it's a place where the door is open, and if there are bolt-on services that we could then bring in, so that it's less confusing to the market, essentially, then that's something we could look at. And even at an absolute basic level, one action I can take away is simply creating a blog page that signposts to all these resources, and maybe separate it by you know, just a simple blog with hyperlinks that separates inspiration activities, outreach activities, you know, strand specific organizations. That could be a starting point.
I've got one of those pages actually on my Magnificent Women site.
Brilliant. Which, we'll signpost to that then.
Well, no, I mean, it's just where I put things, and people are always getting in touch with me and saying, oh, I found your page, and I found another thing that you could add to this list. So then I add other things, and I'm always adjusting that. But Yeah, I do this work on the history of women in engineering,
yeah,
which is something that I really like doing. And I've been doing some outreach around that as well. And I had in the summer this 5 meter by 5 meter stakes and ladders game made
take
to the British Science Festival in Cheltenham, which was great and a real piece of public engagement. And, you know, I had it really ready for the centenary of the Women's Engineering Society, but then the British Science Festival got postponed then in that year. So I've used it this year instead. But if this was not a podcast, you'd be able to see a small version of it behind me. I'll show you in a minute, Mark. It's this little tabletop Snakes and Ladders games. And oh, nice. You start at 1919 and you see the progress of women throughout the 100 years, and you go up and down depending on happened to their it was it. Very interesting to do.
Did you create that yourself?
I did, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's great in full size. It was really good because people play it with them set, you know, we have these massive dice that they throw, and then they can walk around it and read all of the things that have happened.
Oh, we'll need to get that for the Eco Engineers Careers Fairs.
Yeah, it's very engaging. It's
good. Oh, that's a great idea. Great idea. So bringing it up to, I mean, we've sort of been covering what you're working on now, but in the last 4 years, you've been working as a visiting professor at Aston University, and more recently as a Royal Society Entrepreneur in Residence at King's College London. Can you tell us a little bit more about your areas of focus?
Yeah, so at Aston, the thing that I was doing there is when I left Wes, actually, I wanted to move on because I saw really getting more diversity in engineering as being a step on the way to something else that we were trying to achieve and not the end of the line, if you like. So the thing that I wanted to focus more on what it was we were trying to achieve by getting that diversity, and that was inclusive outcomes of engineering. So making sure that we produced things and we created a world, if you like, that was more accessible, more equal. And I do quite a lot of work around gender and women around the world and how we need to ensure that we're creating things that understand, creating technologies that understand the roles of women around the world, mm-hmm. and how they are disadvantaged by, you know, the societal role that they have and the cultural roles or the, you know, religious the ways that they are different because of different cultural what's the word I'm looking for?
Norms.
Yes. Norms. Yeah. And especially recently around climate change. So, you know, we don't know enough of that. We don't have enough crossover in engineering, I don't think, with social science and understand how our engineering has the ability or not to create more equality in the world. So I wanted to do more around focusing on inclusive engineering outcomes, which is what I did with my visiting professorship at Aston. So looking, for example, at the really, you know, easy things, which are things like bias in our technology. So they're really easy. I say easy because they're quite easy to see, you know. So a soap dispenser that doesn't dispense soap if your hand is black is, you know, pretty easy to understand. Or facial recognition software that doesn't recognize people with black skin or people, you know, or women, as well as it recognizes white men. That's pretty straightforward and we can grasp that. But there are all sorts of other ways that we're embedding this inequality into our engineering. So, you know, we won't know it, but the choice of materials that we make when we're creating ducting for a building, for example, could have very different impacts on different communities. Mm. So trying to understand that, trying to understand how our choices in engineering can make a better society is what I was focusing on with this visiting professorship. And it's also what I've been trying to do really with the World Federation of Engineering Organizations, where I'm the Women in Engineering deputy chair. And that's what we put to COP, actually. So this last month, we went to COP26 and spoke about the gender, engineering and climate change nexus. And so that's an area that I've been really interested in the last few years, and learning all sorts about the gender side of, you know, social science, and how this stuff that has been known by many, many people for a long time, but just not us in engineering, really, and how we can translate that. So that's one area that I have been interested in. And then what I'm doing at King's College London is the Royal Society Entrepreneur in Residence Award, where I'm trying to help young engineers and undergraduates, really, or postgraduates, think of themselves as change makers and having the ability to create technology that addresses the sustainable development goals. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for me, they are the big issues that we have in every aspect of, you know, everyone's work these days, and certainly in engineering. And I think lots of the problems that we have could be solved by being more entrepreneurial. And I've seen quite a lot of a shift, really, in the engineering sector, where we are embracing that entrepreneurship in engineering and technology. And I wanted to focus on that and try to help engineers see themselves, because basically an entrepreneur and an engineer are very, very close. And yet we rarely think of ourselves in the engineering sector as entrepreneurs, because I think we think that that's someone with lots of, you know, confidence and money and that finance background and, you know, management background. Whereas actually it's about problem solving and innovation and matching, you know, understanding the need and creating something with the technology that we have at our disposal to match the problems that we have in the world, really. So that's what I'm doing at King's. So both of those are interesting to me.
Definitely keep yourself busy. They're no small feats then. They're all quite big and impactful. And I'm sure you'll go, you know, you will be having impact. You are having impact. Just by virtue of being there, your personal story, the work that you've been doing, you know, the students that are on the courses at these, at these institutions benefiting from your experience that you've been applying through any lectures that you've been given. So what do you think are the biggest challenges and also opportunities facing the profession?
Challenges, for sure, you know, climate change is the challenge that we have. And I think that now, probably as a result of going to COP26, you know, I feel like we need to have that in the back of our mind with everything that we do. And, you know, the big challenge of biodiversity loss as well is something that's, you know, that both of those things are huge and massively impactful. So, you know, the opportunities are that, as you know, we don't have as many people and there certainly is as much diversity as we could do in the engineering sector. So that's still an opportunity to get more and to get more people to think about, you know, I'm not really so much interested in whether they become engineers or not. I think sometimes we can get a bit distracted by trying to get people to be an engineer, but actually it's not really about that. It's about the problems that we're trying to solve. We need lots of different types of people to solve those problems, and engineering is definitely one pathway to that. But I think, you know, if we started to focus on what we wanted people to do as opposed to what we want people to study and to be, then maybe we would be a bit more successful in getting people to do that aren't really, you know, the same old people that always fall by default into engineering.
I like that. I like that wraparound, as in focus more on the problems and what solutions we need, And then let that, and engineering is but one pathway to that. If our pursuit of that helps diversify other STEM pathways or even other artistic ways like behavioral scientists, you know, other
Exactly.
modes that are
Yeah.
needed, then
Because
that's
I think lots of solutions come at those boundaries between different disciplines. And I think, you know, if you can get people out of their silos and into this space where you're all trying to solve a problem, and you know, we can, there's nothing to stop us in engineering getting a much better grasp on the social issues as well. We don't have to always, you know, think, oh, well, we're the technical specialists. We have to understand that systems thinking and have that empathy as well with other sectors and know how the decisions that we make as engineers are impacting people, you know, because it's people that are at the heart of this, you know, whole thing really, isn't it? And their behaviors. So yeah, I think that's the opportunity we've got in engineering, and also to reclaim it to be something that we can all identify with, so that, you know, when we think of it as our sector.
I love that. I love that.
I wrote actually the chapters of the UNESCO Engineering Report for Sustainable Development last year. So I
Wow.
wrote the EDI chapter and the Women in Engineering chapter, and they had some recommendations that I'm pretty keen to follow up on, because we've got so many reports with recommendations in that never go anywhere. So I personally want to try and follow up on those. And I'd like to work more with UNESCO and find a way of doing that. And you know, working with WFEO is actually really positive, because they're a huge global organization with 100 national members. So there's great opportunity there for creating change around the world and doing more of this capacity building in other countries as well. So
Love it.
yeah, there's still lots to do.
Well, let's keep at it then. Do a podcast in a couple of years' time and we'll see the difference.
Yeah.
Thanks, Dawn. I've really enjoyed chatting today.
Well, you too, Mark, as always. And we'll catch
Thanks.
up next time in face to face.
Absolutely. You have been listening to the Equal Engineers podcast, uncovering the diversity story behind leading engineers and those working with the profession championing change. If you've enjoyed the episode, please subscribe to the podcast on your podcast platform of choice and get notified when a new episode goes live. Did you know that we also offer a full transcript on each of our podcast episodes? Check out our website, equalengineers.com. Explore our wider training and development programs, our recruitment events, recognition awards, and case studies for how we are shaping the future of engineering. For now, thank you for listening, and please come back and join us on a future episode.